Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, I'll talk with Ashley Neshlinas, who has just earned her PhD in educational psychology from Iowa State University. She's been blind since birth. I'll talk with her about how she hopes to use her experiences to help other students and teachers in the future. But first, are you planning a trip to Europe? Maybe you want to live vicariously through someone else's journey? Elizabeth Bingham has got you covered. She lives in Waverly, Iowa, but she's traveled the world and her books have helped others travel. She's written German, Italian, and French survival guides designed to help travelers acquire the language and cultural knowledge they need to travel with confidence. And she's also published two travel memoirs, French Twist and German Shepherd. And she is with me now. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks.
Now, you live in Waverly now, and that's also where you grew up, right?
Mostly, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Exactly. I actually grew up in Shell Rock, but the schools are combined, and so Waverly's pretty much home, yes.
All right. So tell me how you got an interest in language learning when you were growing up, because that's really where this love started, right?
Well, I think I don't even know how to answer that because I have always been interested. It's always been there. I think it probably goes back to the fact that my grandparents hosted a foreign exchange student from Austria when I was 3 years old. And I spent a lot of time with them and with her. And so when she returned to Austria, we had this connection. And so I was very interested in Europe in particular. And when I was old enough to start studying languages, I did.
And you started studying German when you were old enough?
Yeah, I started in high school with German and went through high school. And then I continued to college and studied German. And then I was fortunate enough to be able to spend longer time periods in Austria and in Germany and eventually acquire fluency.
Now, after you graduated from high school, that's when your first trip to Europe came, right?
Yes, it did.
Tell me about that first trip.
Ooh, that was a student trip. There were a number of us from high schools, from multiple different high schools, who joined together to go on a bus tour through Germany and Switzerland and Austria. And that was back when it was still a divided Germany. And so we had to go through the long corridor from Bavaria up to Berlin and have the stops with the German Shepherd dogs and everything. And obviously we saw much more than that. We saw beautiful countryside. We had met beautiful people and just had a wonderful time. But what sticks out strongest in my memory is the East German trip.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you really got bitten by the travel bug. Was that the moment, that trip, or when do you think it happened for you?
It all predated that, and I can't even tell you why. It was just always there. I wasn't even dormant. It was just there in this urge to want to see the world.
As you were studying German in college and beyond, I mean, you have your PhD. This became an academic pursuit for you. What were your hopes? What were your career aspirations?
Well, at one point, I did want to get into teaching linguistics, possibly teaching German, and I loved teaching college-level German when I was at the University of Texas at Austin. But when I finished, I was in the mid-90s, and the academic situation was bleak. It was dire. There were no positions available. I was lucky to get a couple interviews even, but there were places I didn't really want to go to. And so my husband is in computer science, and there are plenty of jobs in computer science. So we went where he was able to get positions, and I just kind of redirected my interests.
What brought you back to Iowa?
We had kids. Well, actually, we moved back to Iowa before we had kids, but we were in Texas for our graduate work, and then a position came open at Drake that he was interested in, so we started off in Des Moines, and then we had kids, which is what got us back to Northeast Iowa.
So here you are, back in Iowa. The academic outlook is pretty bleak, but you have acquired all of these skills. You still have this fascination in travel, but you've also got kids, which kind of keep you tied
right
where you are.
Right.
Oh. What changed? What changed your thinking and gave you the idea of writing these survival guides?
I had been asked to teach adult education German courses for Hawkeye College. At that time, it was Hawkeye Tech up in Waterloo. And so I was developing German materials for adult learners, most of whom were getting ready to go on trips abroad. And there was just nothing that suited what I wanted to do. And so I developed my own materials and at some point realized that, wait a minute, if this stuff isn't out there already for other people to use, why don't I just develop it? And so I started with the language material and then thought, well, they really need to know this cultural information too. And so expanded that and ended up with the kind of book that I would have liked to have had before I went to Germany or Austria the first time. And from there, it just went to the other languages because I'd been to Italy and not been able to speak Italian. And then I'd been back with just the very basics of Italian. And it made such a big difference that I continued.
You know, I think any of us who have ever looked at the bookstore at a section of travel books, I mean, there are lots and lots and lots of travel books. But what did you feel was missing? What was it that you were looking for that you just couldn't find?
Well, the language books that teach the language tend to go in a great bit of detail about things that most travelers will never know or care about. Travelers don't need to be able to identify everything in a classroom. Travelers don't need to be able to say the alphabet forwards and backwards. So those books are great for their type of training. And if you've got 2 years to learn the language and prepare for a trip, that can be very appropriate. But when you have 2 weeks, you need something that really gets down to the nuts and the bolts. And there are lots of phrase books that give you phrases that you might need in certain situations. But I don't know whether you've ever tried to use one of those. They are divided by subject. And so if you want to say something about your hotel room, you first have to find the section about the hotels, and then the section about the room, and then the entry that happens to be what you want to do. And so I wanted a completely different and more flexible approach to being able to produce the language, too. It doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to communicate.
Okay, so when you put this together, you mentioned the cultural piece as well, but let's just talk about language. What's your approach into learning what you need to know of a language before you travel?
All right, I probably approach it more different or a little differently from other people because I do have a PhD in language acquisition and applied linguistics. And so I look at what's available in other language books and say, and I distill it. I look at a whole range of materials and say, okay, what do I really need to know about this? And in what order do I need to learn it so it most makes sense and is easiest? Because that is a big goal of mine, is to make the language as accessible as possible, because not everyone has studied language before and they may have no clue how to go about it. And so I also simplify things, because when you're a tourist, you talk about yourself, you use I a lot, and you use you a lot. Do you have this? And you use some third-person singular, where is the whatever? And so everything else, that can go, that can wait, that can be part of someone's future study, but it doesn't have to be part of their beginning study. And when you streamline it, when you get it down to the basics, it's much more manageable.
So you don't think so much about the grammar and the different tenses and the different ways that you can say you in different languages.
No, yeah, because there's you formal, there's you right. informal, there's formal plural, there's informal plural use. I mean, there are so many ways to say you, and when you're a traveler, you're going to use formal singular, and that's pretty much it.
It's funny because the way you describe that kind of makes me think about the way that a person who is traveling abroad would more naturally acquire the language because of what they're hearing in the different circumstances they're engaged in. Is that part of the idea that it just is a little more similar to how our brains would be exposed to this stuff?
Well, I hadn't thought about it that way, but yeah, that makes sense, because what I want to give people is the language they're most likely to use, and the language they're most likely to use is what they'd be most likely to be exposed to and acquiring if they were actually in the country.
Tell me about the cultural aspect. What was it that you felt was missing as far as that goes?
Most language books, and they've gotten better over the years, but most language books traditionally have focused just on the vocabulary and the grammar of the foreign language. And that is a fine start, but when you actually get to the country, you need to know how to take a city bus. You need to know how to order a meal in a restaurant, because different countries have different social practices. And if you don't know those, at the least you're going to feel stupid, and at the worst you're going to offend people or not even know how to get through a day.
When you might get really hungry.
Right. There you go.
Well, and actually, we'll talk more about making the shift to memoir. But in reading some of your memoir, German Shepherd, I mean, that was a very funny part of that memoir, is just understanding how the different meals of the day go. So, for example, the woman who was hosting you would have a hot meal at lunch, but only a cold meal or open-faced sandwiches at supper time. And the first time you visit, you kept missing that big meal of the day. I mean, little things like that are hard to find before you travel, aren't they?
Right, they are. And if you go to Italy and think you're going to have cappuccinos all day, well, you can do that, but you're marking yourself as a tourist, and local people are going to think, you don't know a thing about coffee culture, and they might actually look down at you a little bit because of that. You don't fit in. Cappuccinos only for the morning.
What can I drink in the afternoon?
Espresso. Anything that doesn't have the whipped cream in it, you're fine.
All right. Yeah. Has to be a little less sweeter.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So in pulling out the different cultural things that you wanted to share, what kind of research did you do to be able to put these in your survival guides?
Well, it depends. With the German book, I had so much experience of my own, I drew almost entirely on that. Although I did talk with other people who had traveled in Germany, so what struck you as something that was different from at home? And that's how I came up with, for example, something that I knew about, but I just hadn't thought to include. In a German hotel, when you go down for breakfast, there will be usually some sort of plastic container about the size of a coffee container, and that is for putting your waste in, the little butter wrappers or the, you know, just little waste products. And I hadn't thought, oh, well, yeah, that's something good to put in there. And so I did. And there are other things that I wasn't sure about, and I asked locals, people I knew, and that was quite interesting. And that's how 25 years after I first went to Germany, I learned that if it's a soft food, you are not supposed to use your knife on it, because you are implying that it is tough and that the cook did a poor job. And I had no idea of this because I frequently use my knife a lot, even when I don't have to. And so who knows how many people I offended over the years, you know?
All right. Well, hopefully they forgave you.
I hope so. They've invited me back, so that works.
That's very nice. All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest is Elizabeth Bingham. She lives in Waverly, and she's the author of multiple survival guides in German, Italian, and French, designed to help travelers acquire the language and culture they need to travel with confidence. She's also published two travel memoirs, French Twist and German Shepherd. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. You're welcome to join us. What do you think you need to know before traveling to Europe? Do you have any questions for Elizabeth? Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up in a few minutes, I'll talk to Ashley Neshlinas. She's just earned her PhD in educational psychology from Iowa State University. She's hoping to help students with visual impairment learn more effectively in science and math. And this is something that she knows a lot about, since she has been blind since birth. I'll talk with her in about 15 minutes. With me right now is Elizabeth Bingham. She lives in Waverly, Iowa, but she's traveled the world, and her books have helped many other people travel, some of them traveling vicariously with a couple of her memoirs. She's written German, Italian, and French survival guides, and most recently published two travel memoirs, French Twist and German Shepherd, and she is with me now. Now, Elizabeth, we've been talking a lot about these survival guides and where that idea came about. Now let's talk about the shift that you took to writing memoir. What made you think it's time to start telling my stories?
Well, part of it was a time constraint, that by the time I'm always unrealistic and think, oh, I'll be able to do another language book in 6 months, but I can never do a language book in 6 months. It takes 2 years, and it is extremely, it's very labor intensive. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to take a switch the circumstances have changed. People are, if they even bother to learn language anymore, they're going online to get something free or they're downloading.
There's so many apps that you can use.
Yeah, there are apps. You point your phone at something and it translates it for you. And as a language lover and language teacher, this is very painful to me. But I understand the appeal to people who are not interested in those subjects the way I am. It gives you a very different experience when you're in the country than actually interacting with the locals does. But it is a way to get through and be successful in the way that you want to. And so there's less of a demand for language books than there used to be. And it does take so much time and so much research. And if it's not a language I'm already fluent in, which is everything but German, then I have to work closely with people who are experts in those languages to make sure that before I'm done that I have got everything right. And so I thought, I'm going to try something else, see how that goes. And so I switched to writing travel memoir, which also took considerably longer than I thought it should and expected it to. But it did take less time than coming up with a book about a language that I wasn't even fluent in.
So let's talk about your first travel memoir, French Twist. And what I really love about the title, there's a subtitle here. It says, a refreshingly frank travel memoir by a modern American Puritan. So you talk a little bit about culture shock in France. And this book doesn't tell the story of just one journey, but multiple journeys. So what's in the book?
The book is an interweaving of three different trips I had taken at that time, three different trips to France. And the basic structure was on the most recent one at that time, which was with a friend of mine from church, Mickey. And that provided the structure. And as we went through our two-week experience in France, then I drew in experiences from the previous two times I'd been there. Once with my daughter when she was probably seven then. And then once before that, my first trip to France when I was there with my grandmother, who was in her late 70s at that time. And so it was a chance to bring in the different experiences when they happened to coincide with what Mickey and I were doing in that particular time.
Well, and I think about the genre of travel memoir, and so much of that genre is devoted to sort of the romanticism of traveling abroad. And your stories make me want to go.
Oh, really?
But
because they're not romanticized.
Right. No, but I mean, you're incredibly honest about so many of the frustrations that you encounter. Like, give us an example of maybe a story that wouldn't make it into a more traditional travel memoir.
Okay. Well, like the bathroom story?
Sure.
Okay. We had spent the night at the remote island of Mont Saint-Michel, which you would recognize the photo of, even if you don't know the castle itself. It's an old monastery that's on a remote island in northwest France off the coast of Normandy. And we had had our tea in the morning, knowing that we had a long drive to the Loire Valley so we could start viewing the castles there. And that much we knew. What we didn't know is that there would be no bathrooms en route. And so we had a very painful drive. And at some point, when we did eventually come across a public bathroom, ran in and discovered that there were no toilets, and then eventually realized that, these are Turkish toilet bathrooms. And so Mickey had her first experience with what's sometimes called a squatty potty. And then after our desperate visit there, we realized that I had, in fact, directed both of us to use the men's room. And so those things happen when you travel. You just don't know what's going to be coming up. And so, that maybe wouldn't make it in a traditional memoir, but I did feel it was important to be honest. And I have to say that the reaction from some Francophiles has not been positive. They think that I should be rhapsodizing over every pastry that is available in France. And that was just not my experience. And I don't think it's the experience of everyone who goes. And so,
well, your tone when I started reading kind of surprised me. Because, again, I mean, it's very honest and funny, but not always positive. What is it that you love about the adventure of travel?
I suppose it's the challenge and the something new. And what really draws me more than anything is the chance to make connections with people who are from a different culture in a different country. And that was a whole lot harder in France. So France had a lot of challenges for us, because we're both very outgoing and friendly people, and the French are just so reserved. And in fact, if you are outgoing with a French person, you're very often breaking their social rules and being rude. And so that was a tough call for us. Yet it was still fun. If I had been by myself any of those times, I doubt I would have enjoyed it as much. But I was able to have the interactions with someone else and with other people who happened to be, you know, from the United States. And if I'd had the chance to get to know French people, I think it would have been even better. But even so, the experience of stepping back into time, because so much of our history comes from Europe, so much of our cultural heritage is from Europe, that even without the personal interactions, it is just a fascinating experience to me to be able to see where things actually happened.
Well, let's talk about German Shepherd, which is your most recent of mm-hmm. your travel memoirs. And this is, again, you travel with your friend Mickey, mm-hmm. who's one room away watching this conversation, by the way, also yeah. your travel companion today. And in this case, you're in a place where you're very comfortable
yes.
with the language, which really changes everything for you, doesn't it?
It does. It's a much deeper experience. I've got history with the German people I know, with the country, with my own experiences with the country. And it is like I describe it, it's like a big warm hug compared to traveling to someplace like France, where it's much more formal and reserved.
Well, and so much of that memoir is about someone that you have a very deep connection with in Germany. You call her your German grandmother.
Oh, my German mother.
Your German mother, yeah. Inga. Tell mm-hmm. me about her. And how did you make this connection with her?
Inga is actually a relative on my husband's side. My mother-in-law was first cousins with her and her siblings. They were raised in East Prussia, which is now part of Poland. And they were in East Prussia during the Second World War. Afterwards, the siblings all managed to survive and get west to what remained Germany. But they were there for the horrible aftermath of the war. They were refugees, and it was awful. And at some point, when they were settled enough to be able to contact relatives in the West, they had said where they were and were requesting aid. And my husband's grandparents then ended up sending a lot of care packages through the Red Cross and then privately and establishing this connection because they were relatives. These were their nieces and nephews who were struggling to survive after the war. And then as Germany started to recover from the war, well, these relatives, this particular branch of the family, all ended up in East Germany. And so they were separated from the Western relatives for decades. And occasionally there would be some sort of contact. When things loosened up a little bit in the 80s, I got to know an East German poet who was visiting UNI at the time I was studying there. And he said, oh, he could get a message to this Inga, this cousin. And he did. And so we were able to establish some correspondence with her. And so we had a connection with her before I was there and actually met her in person. And since then, she has been my home in Germany. She is just the most wonderful, warm person. And she has such a deep and abiding gratitude for any of the American relatives, because as far as she's concerned, they saved her life after the war, that they would have starved afterwards. She thinks they wouldn't have made it. I mean, they were eating weeds and cats, you know, whatever they could find.
So when did you first meet her? I mean, you were able to exchange this message. When did you first get to actually meet her face to face?
I met her in summer of 1989.
And that was a very eventful year for Germans.
It was indeed. And actually, we met her right before the Tiananmen Square massacre. And so there was a lot in the news about repressive state governments. And this was right after we had met her for the day in East Germany, because we were not allowed to go to her home. And it was just a shocking reminder that countries are not free. Not every country is free. And some people have to live like that.
You end up telling quite a lot of her story in yeah. your memoir. What do you want people to know about her experience, what she went through in this divided Germany?
What I would like people to do is not forget what happened, the atrocities that happened, because it is so easy to look the other way and to think, oh, things are going to get better. And they don't always get better. Sometimes they snowball, and before you know it, you've got a World War II, and you've got the Holocaust, and you've got the refugee situation. And it's very hard to look, for example, at the Syrian refugees and not recognize that that's the type of situation that Inga was in and that others had gone through, and how horrendously difficult it is.
With the trip that you describe in German Shepherd, you and Mickey set off for 2 weeks. At that point, did you think when you left for that trip, did you think, I'm going to write a book about this trip?
At that point, I think that was the summer that French Twist came out. And so I did have a good idea that, okay, there's a good chance that this could develop in the same sort of thing. And again, use the structure of our trip to bring in previous trips and be able to talk about some of the history of my experiences with Germany and then some of Inga's histories with Germany and then German history itself. So yeah, at that point, I had a good idea.
Now, both of the trips that you've taken with Mickey have been about 2 weeks long, or the both of the ones that you've written about so
right.
far. There are others.
Yes, there are. There are.
All right. But 2 weeks, it's kind of a traditional amount of time for people who are vacationing in Europe because it takes so long to get
right,
there.
Right.
And is that, would you recommend traveling for 2 weeks?
I recommend traveling for whatever you can make work. And I have traveled as long as 5 weeks at a stunt. I've been there studying in the summer for the school year and things that are longer. But actually, as a tourist, I've been there up to 5 weeks and as little as 6 days. And they're both rewarding experiences. And I would say that if someone is looking to travel, do it whenever you can or however you can, because you never know when you'll have the opportunity again.
So if you do have an opportunity to take a trip, let's talk about how you would recommend that someone prepare. I mean, I think about you and Mickey traveling together, going to Germany that felt like a nice warm hug for you. She doesn't have the same kind of background with Germany that you do, although traveling with you must have given her a kind of entree into that culture that she didn't have when you traveled together to France, for example.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yes. I was able to give her much more information about Germany. And in fact, she would have felt more comfortable there on her own anyway, because we're from a heavily German area of the state. And in fact, her family and her husband's family are all from Germany. And so the German customs are much more similar to what we have in Northeast Iowa than the customs in France were.
So depending on where you're going and who you're traveling with, do you prepare for a trip in a different way depending on the needs or level of interest of your travel companion?
Oh, absolutely. I'm in the process right now of developing a trip that is going to work well for people who are maybe not quite so physically mobile, but other people who are extremely physical. And so it has to be flexible enough so that the people who can't do a lot of walking will still have a rewarding experience. And the people who want to be very active and get out all over the place will have the opportunity to do that.
So clearly, from the survival guides that you've written, you would recommend somebody spend some time studying the language. How much do you feel like we need to know, and why is it so important?
Well, I think if you get the basics down, I have an absolute bare bones basics in the front of all my books. Know how to say yes, no, thank you, please, and oh my gosh, excuse me. Yes, I think that's the fifth one. If you know those, you've started at least. And honestly, if people can just cram phrases on the flight over, they will still make a better impression than if they just assume that everyone's going to speak English with
so
them.
So it's not even so much about what that would give you, but the kind of respect that shows to the people that you're interacting with, that you're at least attempting to speak
right
their
at
language.
At the beginning levels, that's certainly the case. But even with the tourist Italian or French that I was able to acquire at the times when I was studying, that can make a huge difference in your experience there too. So it does come back and enrich the individual also.
In what way?
Well, for one thing, people tend to be a little warmer if you're making an attempt in their language. For another, they're more likely to use their English on you if you've shown that you can use that you're willing to make mistakes in their language, that the ego stakes aren't as high anymore. If you're lucky, you'll make a connection with someone that you wouldn't have been able to make otherwise. And even if it is speaking a pidgin version of the language, you can still connect with people. You can still communicate a lot, and that makes a huge difference to me.
Now, and just briefly, let's talk again about the cultural aspect, because a lot of us base our trips on, oh, I want to see this, I want to go there, I want to do that. We're more place-centric than culture-centric. So when we travel, how do you recommend that people give themselves an opportunity to really experience some of the culture?
Well, sometimes I can be guilty of that also. If I've done the research and made out a possible itinerary and think, oh, I want to go this and this and this and this. And sometimes I do manage to do that. But I do recommend to people that they consider not doing one of their site visits and instead go to a department store, go to your favorite section in a store. Look at the kitchen utensils in France and see how they're different from at home. Maybe leave something at home that you'd like to have but don't actually have to have, and make it your goal to find a replacement when you're in the other country, because those are situations that tourists don't necessarily get into, but they reveal so much about the country itself. Yeah.
At this point in time, do you have one, we've got about 30 seconds left, just one key bit of wisdom? You talked about how technology kind of can disconnect us from people.
Yeah.
So if we're traveling, do you have advice about how to not fall into that pitfall?
Well, it's probably the same advice that we should be following more in the U.S., which is put your phones away. Yeah, and actually see what's going on around you and what's happening, because you'll see the same tourists in Italy or in France or in Germany or in England staring at their phones.
Elizabeth Bingham, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. I've enjoyed it.
Elizabeth Bingham has written German, Italian, and French survival guides designed to help travelers acquire the language and cultural knowledge they need to travel with confidence. She's also published two travel memoirs, French Twist and German Shepherd. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with Ashley Nashlinas, who's just earned her PhD in educational psychology. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.